The Curbsiders Teach podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions.
Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the speakers and should not be interpreted to reflect the official policy or position of any entity. You should always do your homework and give us any feedback.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Season 6 of Curbsiders Teach, our series on health professions education. I'm Dr. Ira Kuzhinovskaya, joined by my new and amazing co-host, Dr. Mike Chang, on the first half of the recap. On today's episode, we'll review the top hits from Seattle's AIM Week 26 as a recap episode. Before we get started with that, Mike, will you remind the audience what we do on the show?
Sure. We are the health professions podcast for all things education. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to inspire the next generation of clinician educators. We have such a great conversation as we're joined by our incredible guests. For this part one, Drs. Finney and Bigdahl to reflect on the amazing conference, Academic Internal Medicine Week 2026, that we're at, and to share some pearls from favorite workshops and other sessions.
Thank you, Mike. And to introduce our guests, we have first Dr. Lauren Finney, who is a general internist clinician educator at the University of California, San Francisco, where she practices primary care and urgent care. She attended UCSF for med school, internal medicine residency, chief year, and recently joined faculty. She has an interest in education research in areas of evaluation, trainee, and physician well-being, and now AI tool integration and clinical training. She's attending UC Berkeley for her master's in education next year.
And we have Dr. Ray Bigdahl, who is the Chief Diversity and Health Equity Officer at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, and an Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Ohio State University College of Medicine. A graduate of Howard University and Meharry Medical College, Dr. Bigdahl completed his pediatrics residency, clinical fellowship in nephrology, and NIH postdoctoral research fellowship at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Dr. Bigdahl's work addresses the social determinants of kidney, child, and community health through community-based scholarship, engagement, and advocacy. He is the 2026 AIM Week opening plenary speaker. His talk is titled, Do You See What I See? Five Lessons I've Learned About Mentorship as a Black Man in a White Coat.
Well, so good to see you all. Hi, Drs. Finney and Bigdahl. Is it okay if we call you Lauren and Ray, respectively?
Absolutely.
Yeah, sounds
awesome.
Good.
I almost made a combo of your names and said Lorraine. So if y'all ever decide to have a medical collaboration or education collaboration, that could potentially be, or a Ralauren could be another one.
Crossover episode. Awesome.
Thank you guys for bearing with me with that. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Let's maybe start with some rapid fire questions to get to know you a little better. Can you give us a one-liner to describe yourself and maybe include something outside of medicine? Ray, you're a returning guest. We're so lucky to have you. Do you mind going first with a one-liner?
Sure. So my name is Ray Bigdahl. I am a pediatric nephrologist at Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, where I also serve as the Chief Health Equity Officer. And right now, the thing I'm most excited about is being the dad of a three-year-old who is tired all the time. but we're having lots of fun in the house.
That's amazing. I feel like we can all kind of relate to being tired all the time. So I feel like the three-year-old's in good hands, you know?
My little nephew was three, so.
Yes, we
definitely
can.
Definitely empathize with all the energy that they have.
It's a special age. It's a special age. But we're trying to keep our wits about us.
Stay strong, Ray. Stay strong. And then, Lauren, do you want to share a one-liner about you?
Yeah, great. Thank you for having me. I'm Lauren Finney. I'm a 30-something-year-old general internist, originally from Northern California, and I identify not only as a generalist in my work, but also in my hobbies, which I've returned to in full force now that I'm an attending starting this year. And so my rotation currently includes some volleyball, backpacking, cycling with my fiance, and then I most recently joined a Latin dancing performance team, and I'm still trying to keep up my yoga practice now that I'm an attending. So it's been fun to return to all my hobbies.
Wow. You are, I saw Ray's eyes go wide. I think all of us are always mesmerized by how Lauren is able to get it all done, and she does somehow. It's incredible.
You forgot rock climbing though.
Oh, no, I didn't put rock climbing in there. You're right.
My gosh, we have to re-record the one-liner. Just kidding. You know, Lauren's, that's amazing. Which of those is your favorite? You don't have to have one, but which is your favorite?
Like Taylor Swift, I have eras of my hobbies. And so I was in a rock climbing phase. My rock climbing era was actually in residency because the rock climbing gym's always open no matter what time you get off of work, whether you're post-call or whatever. And now I'm in my like salsa dancing, bachata dancing era and really trying to build up that skill.
Thank you both for introducing yourselves. We'll get into the nitty-gritty about the workshops and sessions y'all have attended here at AIM Week 2026. But before we dive in, we'd love to hear how it's been in terms of your experience broadly. Anything surprised you? Any kind of take-homes you already have? Just, you know, broad sense since being here.
Oh, I guess I could start. This is my first time attending AIM. I have experience with similar conferences from the pediatrics world. We have a few collaborative conferences, like what I would describe this as, where there are many different societies that are together and sort of with shared mission and shared cause. So it was really exciting to see all of the different groups gathered together for AIM. Obviously, I'm a pediatrician. I am a visitor, a wayfaring traveler in the internal medicine world, but just absolutely have enjoyed connecting with so many IM friends from across the country and so many wonderful people that I was able to connect with after the opening session today. That was really exciting. And you guys have an amazing exhibit floor. Really cool to see 200 posters from trainees who are presenting their work and their projects in the medical education space. And I think the future is really bright for this group of internists, and just a really terrific opportunity to connect with so many people from across the country.
Well, I think our future is brighter, Ray, because of you and your amazing opening plenary, which we'll get to obviously in a second to recap that. But thank you so much for pumping us up in terms of our sponsor, AIM. We're very, very grateful and very lucky to be sponsored by them, but also that they recognize greatness when they see it and invited you to come speak. So thank you so much for
that.
And we'll get to it.
Thank
of course,
you.
We'll dive super deep into that session. But maybe before we get into that, Lauren, just as part of the intro, you know, would love to hear how your experience at AIM has been so far, surprised you, any kind of quick take homes you've learned before we get to the sessions.
This is also my first time at AIM. I'm super excited to be here. I feel really inspired by seeing all the rising chief residents. I was recently a chief resident, so seeing everyone coming to this this conference with a lot of energy and ideas. And I'm seeing a lot of really cool workshops and plenary sessions about really timely topics like advocacy, climate health, well-being, AI everywhere, and then funding in this economy too. And so it's been really fun to bop around and seeing all those sessions, and I'm excited for the poster session later today. I think my main takeaway, just plainly speaking, there was a puppy area on the second floor where all the posters were, and they are open from 11 to 2 every day. And I spent like an hour there today during lunch just hanging out with the puppies. And I think that I would advocate for every conference and every hospital system to have a little puppy area, because I feel cured. Honestly, I feel very well after that experience.
I feel like many people have mentioned the puppies being a highlight. I personally found it a highlight as well. So,
yeah, I think the puppies would be a highlight for everyone, except we had one guest who's allergic to dogs. So that person is not going to be going to see the puppies. But everyone else definitely hit up the puppies. So appreciate that. Awesome. Well, maybe, Mike, what do you think? Should we kind of jump into talking about Ray's plenary?
Yes. Ray gave the opening plenary session. It was titled, Do You See What I See? 5 Lessons I've Learned About Mentorship as a Black Man in a White Coat. Is it okay, Ray, that we asked you to give us a synopsis of it, a kind of a bite-sized synopsis, and, you know, whatever the kind of key points that you want our listeners to be aware of?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I just want to once again say thank you for the invitation to come and speak. I don't take it lightly when folks invite me to speak at conferences like this. And it's a real honor for colleagues in the field of medicine, especially outside of your specialty, to reach out to you for the opportunity to speak and connect over your work. And so I'm just so incredibly grateful, thankful for the opportunity to speak to you guys today. It was such a full room, which was also really cool to see. I think that is often a challenge as a speaker. I can speak from experience where you have the first lecture of the day and the room is empty because everyone is at getting coffee or still trying to wake up. So for so many people to be out so early just speaks to the enthusiasm that this conference brings and what everyone is excited to see. So just really a wonderful experience for me and a lot that I'll remember. Mentorship is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. And I probably would not have gotten this invitation were it not for the incredible experience I had on the podcast recently with you all and the opportunity that I had to speak a little bit about mentorship there. And we had such a wonderful, rich conversation. It just reminded me of some of the challenges around mentorship, some of the nuance around mentorship, especially for those of us in academic medicine, where we really are learning in an apprenticeship type environment. We're learning from people who have done it before us, people with more experience. Mm-hmm. It's not just textbook learning like many of us are used to. It really is experiential learning. And it's learning that happens through the vehicle of another individual, a more experienced individual. Mm. And that's a very unique type of career. There's not very many careers like this where you really have to sit at the feet of someone more experienced, metaphorically speaking, and learn from them. Mm-hmm. And so understanding mentorship is incredibly important. Lauren, you're an attending now. And I remember when I was transitioning from being a fellow to being an attending, I didn't really know how to do any of this. Like I knew what to make of mentorship. I knew the great mentors I had and the not so great mentors I had and the experiences that I had with each of them. I kind of knew what I wanted to replicate and what I didn't want to replicate. And so really the whole idea behind this talk was to just speak about some of the important lessons that I've learned along the way. I certainly don't think that I'm like a world-renowned expert in mentorship, but there were some really great papers and research articles that I referenced in the talk today from folks who have done truly groundbreaking work summarizing the extant literature on mentorship, launching programs for mentorship. It's been pretty cool. I had five takeaways, and these were those five takeaways. Number one, I think we should think about the power of mentoring an unseen future. That was kind of the tagline I used to talk about the mentorship that many of us get from our families. My father is a PhD physicist. My mom has her doctorate in education. For a long time, I had the opportunity to look up to both of them as models of what academic success looks like. But I also spoke about the experience of my grandmother, who, like many other members of our physician community around the country, was herself an immigrant. And she was a domestic worker in the homes of wealthy individuals in South Florida for 30 or 40 years. And during that time, that career, she sacrificed so much in order to give a future for my father and for me. And so I look back at those relationships as powerful examples of mentorship. I talked about the importance of centering the mentee. That was the second lesson. The idea that our mentees really should drive the mentorship relationship and not the other way around. I think sometimes, unfortunately, some mentors can exhibit bad habits, sometimes exploiting the relationship with the mentee, or other times being dismissive of mentees who reach out to others for help. And we should remember to always center the mentee when we are being mentors. My third lesson was talking about peer mentorship. I have had some really awesome friends in medicine who have provided me with excellent mentorship along the way too, which is really cool to see. And I think many of us benefit from what we would consider, who we would consider rather peer mentors. They might just be like our buddies from residency or fellowship or medical school, but actually sometimes the relationship grows to be more than that, accountability and role modeling that takes place amongst our friends. That's pretty cool too. The fourth lesson was the power of being mentored up, or reverse mentoring. These are terms that are used to describe the phenomenon where the mentee teaches the mentor. And I talked about some of the really great lessons that I've learned from my mentees. And the last lesson was about the power of long-term commitment. Really, mentorship relationships are not really great if they're time-bound, you know? Some of the best mentorship relationships are long-term. They grow and evolve with the mentor and mentee, just like a relationship with a family. You know, who I am now as an almost 40-year-old man is different from who I was when I was four. And the relationship that I have with my parents and my family has evolved over that time too. But we've learned so much together. We love each other so much. And I think this, something similar happens with our mentorship relationships over the long haul as well.
Wow, Ray, that was a masterclass. And I do want to highlight that I know you said you're not an expert, but I might subtly push back on that, because you have not only created so many kind of dissemination literature, you know, digital scholarship, our the episode you referenced, number 46, Mentoring 2.0, Best Practices for Mentoring Across Differences, that was with you. I mean, you are, I would say, an expert, and those five lessons, I think, really solidified, you know, what mentoring is and how it can be even better because of, you know, what we learned from you. Lauren, Mike, and I were all listening, and we all have our thoughts on it, our reflections based on your incredible words, and maybe wanted to take some time to hear from other folks and then, you know, just hear more about how you kind of put together this talk, because it's one thing where you have so much wisdom and you have shared it, you know, before digitally with us and in other scholarship and in other venues, but it takes a lot to kind of put it together in the dynamic way that you really did. And so I want to open it up, obviously, to Mike and Lauren, and we can all share some thoughts, but just a huge kind of gratitude, and also just like for your maybe to elevate and say you are an expert, and thank you for sharing that expertise. But I'll turn it over to Mike and Laura to share some reflections.
I'll add to that. I think that in the room, being there in the room during that plenary was really special. I think at my point in my career, which is early, I was a chief resident last year. I'm a new faculty this year. I'm kind of at the point of, I've received so much good mentorship over the last 9 years in medical school and training. And I'm now at a point where I was always being the mentee paired with mentors at these conferences. And now it's starting to be the other way around. But it actually really made me think about all the mentorship that I've been giving to people and receiving from my peers. I actually got like 3 texts from folks in the room while during that part of your talk, I think point number 3, which was mentor your peers, where people were like, oh, you're like my friend from medical school who's now at Columbia was like, you're my mentor and you're here. And like, we should hang out today. Or one of our residents who texted me to just say like, hey, I appreciated you. And so it was actually really special to build community in that moment in the room during that talk. And I felt like that part was very powerful. And I'll just say that it really got me thinking about, as a young faculty in primary care, how to create and find more opportunities now, formal and informal, to mentor folks going into our field, especially with diversity and inclusion in mind. And I know you had a big point around that, that you talked about as well. So yeah, really appreciated that talk.
It's really cool. I think we do sometimes forget the ways in which we mentor, like implicitly or explicitly, with the people around us. And a lot of folks wouldn't even necessarily think that. One thing you might learn, Lauren, as you start progressing in your career too, is you might find yourself mentoring senior faculty members. This is something that I've only recently discovered in my own life, in some subtle ways, small ways. But, you know, I will have some faculty members who will come by my office and they'll ask me questions or they'll raise some concern and we'll sort of talk through something really quickly. And it's only later I'm thinking about the conversation and I realize, oh, snap, they actually were coming to me for advice. Like, you know, because it's just not the way we're used to thinking, right? Like, I'm the younger person, the littler person, the bigger person is the one who's supposed to give me something. What could I possibly have to give them? And so I think as you start to grow in your career journey, you're going to see these things happen too. And it's really powerful when they happen to kind of recognize what's happening and use that moment as an opportunity to share something positive with those around us. So good for you. I'm really glad that those people reached out. I'm sure that felt great.
And Ray, I should second your point because as somebody who worked with Lauren during her chief year a bit, I saw her actually having senior folks come to her and very subtly, but maybe also not so subtly, kind of hear what her thoughts were about a certain situation. So I would say you foreshadowed it, Ray, and Lauren has had those incredible moments, and you know the future is quite bright for more moments like that.
Yeah, and I want to say just one more quick thing about this. This actually happened to me personally recently, where I went to one of my trainees and asked for their advice on a clinical case. And I'll be honest, mm-hmm. it was a little because this is a senior fellow who is actually specializing in a particular area of nephrology, glomerular disease nephrology. And she is regularly in glomerular clinic with some of the senior faculty. And it happened to be that none of the other faculty members from that clinic were in their office. So like, I was like looking around for someone, you know, for advice. And I could have shot an email off really quickly to one of them mm-hmm. and maybe would have gotten back an answer. But I actually intentionally took a breath and said, you know what, I'm going to go and ask my fellow. And I knocked on her door. I said, Dr. Phillips, I want to get your advice. And it was really powerful to see the way that she kind of like oriented to me asking that question. She gave great advice. You know, I'm a nephrologist, I'm an attending. I know how I wanted to manage that case. But I also know that she has some special expertise. And I was glad to have asked her for her advice. And I also think that it might have helped give her a little encouragement and strengthen her abilities to give good advice as a faculty member or a future faculty member. So these are cool dynamics to kind of watch play out.
Yeah, and I think adding to the theme of what you all have been sharing, I think for me, what stuck in my mind with the plenary was just the rich network of mentoring in terms of those you've mentored, those who've mentored you. I know you're mentioning, you know, peer mentor just earlier now, and then also, you know, more senior mentors and then more junior individuals mentoring you. You know, I think it's just nice to know and to have that reassurance that mentorship isn't just one-on-one, but also a whole network with an individual. And I thought that was really encouraging just to see kind of the unique ways in which you also found mentorship. I know you mentioned connecting with some individuals on Twitter, RIP, you know. I know you mentioned another individual that you mentored was someone related to a patient of yours, you know. So just hearing those stories was really interesting and really eye-opening to see, hey, mentorship doesn't have to happen in just one way. Mm-hmm. There can be many different avenues for it. So yeah, thank you for the plenary.
Thanks for pointing that out. Yeah, you know, you mentioned at the end about the brother of a patient that was hospitalized at Cincinnati Children's Hospital when I was a resident. This was actually a patient that I never cared for directly, but I had a chance encounter with her family, and the young man was this patient's older brother. And yeah, we connected and stayed connected over the years. Young man is now graduating from my medical school, The Ohio State University. He was in middle school when I met him, and now he's graduating from medical school at Ohio State and is matching into internal medicine, by the way, and joining the University of North Carolina. His name is Jake Lazinski. He's a really remarkable young man. And it's developing a network of mentors is really key. I think one of the mistakes that people make, we talked about this, I think, in the last podcast, but one of the mistakes that people often make is that they try to fit everything they want out of a mentor into one person. They look for one person, sometimes even the one person who shares the most in common with them, maybe racial concordance or gender concordance or someone in your exact same field or super specialization within your field. That's not realistic. It's way more realistic that you're going to collect mentors like Infinity Stones or Pokemon. Like, you're going to just sort of got to catch them all, right? Like, you're going to have somebody who's great for professional identity, somebody else who's great for clinical care and management, someone who's great for research and academic skills, someone who's great for like interpersonal skills and how you engage with patients and staff. You might need somebody to proofread your emails, you know, somebody who can make your emails longer if they're too short or shorter if they're too long, you know, or maybe you are writing a little spicy email and you might want somebody to help tone it down before, you know, check yourself before you wreck yourself kind of a thing. you know, there's so many incredible ways that we can collect folks in our life and experience who can be great mentors in that way, too.
And one thing I want to call out, Ray, that you kind of mentioned when Molly and I first spoke with you, was a corollary to that mentor map, which is kind of like the coaching tree, where you have learned so much from your mentors who have kind of learned and passed down wisdom to you and their other mentees, and that you replicate, you know, their mentorship, their greatness in your own unique kind of and different way. And that there's ways that we can all take notes of certain patterns or certain behaviors that maybe we do or we don't want to replicate, and kind of thinking about how we authentically replicate those things. I think you spoke about, you know, numerous people who were, you know, they didn't share your interests in maybe advocacy, and maybe they were like a dialysis expert, but they knew what you were going to do and what you wanted to do, and they kind of paired you with the right people, and then like you kind of took that mentorship and also made it your own and kind of passed that down. So I do want to highlight that kind of coaching tree or that kind of mentor network that you've created and also made authentically yours. You know, I think there's often times where people are like, Ira, but like this person doesn't do exactly the things I want to do or how I want to mentor. And I was like, that's okay. That person serves a particular person in your purpose in your network. And there's other people that you can learn from and maybe replicate other things, you know?
Yeah. 100%. I think, you know, the NBA playoffs are going on now, and one of the teams in the playoffs
for Golden State.
Yes. Oh, yes. Too bad. Too bad for the Warriors. They're starting to show their age a little bit, you know. But you know,
me too.
All of us, right? All of us are showing our age. Yes. One of the teams that I've been following a little bit here recently, the San Antonio Spurs, and they're an excellent example of this sort of coaching tree idea, because the Golden State Warriors coach, Coach Steve Kerr, was part of the coaching tree of Greg Popovich, who unfortunately had a cerebrovascular event and is no longer the coach of the head coach of the San Antonio Spurs, but still part of their organization. Mm-hmm. But that ethos, the mindset, the character of him, Greg Popovich, you can see it permeating in his former players and his former players who are now coaches and so forth. And they are carrying that legacy forward. It's really pretty remarkable to see. And they're succeeding. They have a track record of success there. I think there's so much that we can learn when we try to replicate that with our mentors too. You know, mentors are human beings, so they're not going to be perfect, but we can take the good things, the things that we identify as good things from them, and filter out the others. And I think that that's totally okay. It'll allow us to be the best version of ourselves as leaders, which is pretty cool too.
Amazing, Ray. Thank you so much. And obviously, Mike, Lauren, if y'all have any other kind of reflections or things from the amazing open plenary and the five lessons, there were more like 55 lessons in there, Ray, that we want to highlight. Please jump in.
I thought that one of the other quotes that really stuck out to me was a quote from one of your mentees, Ray, about that we must not abandon our values out of fear of those who hear our values. And so I thought that that piece was also really impactful as well. Just, I really appreciated, as someone who's a young faculty myself, just how much you incorporated the quotes and the stories from your mentors and also from your mentees, and just was showing your role modeling for us in real time, that coaching tree and that network. And I know y'all were talking about basketball, but in my head during your talk, I was thinking about Andy Reid and like the Chiefs, you know, and like all of the coaches that he has produced, all, you know, not to bring this back to sports, but like all the coaches that he's produced throughout the NFL and yeah, how we should aim to replicate that in medicine.
Yeah, that's a great example. Andy Reid's cool. We'll give him some props. Andy Reid's cool. I have no shade for Andy Reid. One of the things I really enjoyed about this presentation is it was an opportunity to tell some stories. I think the stories of good mentorship are as impactful or maybe more impactful than any didactic or scholarly report on mentorship could be. Mm-hmm. Just people's real world lived experience with mentors and mentees can really be very powerful. And you're referencing an interaction that I had with one of my former residents, Dr. Kaya Omoa, who's a NICU fellow at UT Houston. And yeah, it was a really powerful moment to be sharing with her sort of earnestly advice about what I thought she should do in order to protect herself as a budding faculty member. And it was kind of like, I think the advice was kind of played out, to be honest, but I was doing what had been modeled for me. And for her to sort of snap me out of it by forcing me to think differently about what support really means and looks like. You know, what I didn't share in the talk today is that after she kind of confronted me with, in a very polite way, like it wasn't like confrontational, but the nature of the conversation was confronting for me. And after I had that conversation with her, I immediately hung up the phone and I called my mentor, a woman by the name of Dr. Aditi Unaka, who is the chief health equity officer at Stanford Lucile Packard Children's in the Bay Area. And I asked her, I said, am I doing the most here? Like, am I not being supportive? And basically she was like, low key, yeah, you're not being supportive of your trainee right now. And you need to figure out like how you can adjust your frame of reference so that you can be a better support for her. And it radically changed the way that I approach situations like that in the future. I have so many examples of things that my trainees have said or done, things that my mentees have said or done that have really radically changed the way that I approach situations in the future. And by the way, I think that's a really important skill for a mentor, is to like learn from the interactions you have with your mentee, not just the things your mentee might say or the things that they might do or produce, but actually learn from the interaction. Like, oh, like have some introspection. Like, oh, that didn't go like so good. Or, you know, actually that was pretty dope. I should do that more. Like we should really think about what we're saying and how we're saying it and how it comes across to make a huge difference.
I think one other thought I had as I was reflecting about the plenary was this mixture of, you know, obviously there's good programs that can pair you with a mentor, at least in our division. We get paired with a faculty mentor. So there are good structured programs, and I know it can be really used well in terms of or just really pairing people with on paper, you know, similar interests and whatnot. I think, you know, you're also mentioning about how some other mentorship relationships can develop quite naturally or kind of unexpectedly in terms of people who you wouldn't expect, and the need for both in terms of the benefits of both, the ones that develop naturally and do complement each other in that way, and the ones that are maybe more formal for a particular purpose. So, yeah, just wanted to mention that as well.
Thanks so much, Mike. Yeah, I think that that's a really good point too. There's so many different models for how to set up a mentorship relationships. I think most often the best ones are, or the most common ones rather, are one-on-one. I ran into this person at a conference, or I saw this person's work and I reached out via email and asked for their advice, or I was on service and this particular attending was super thoughtful and kind, and I really appreciated them and reached out to them for guidance. Those relationships are really great. There's a lot of shade, and honestly, I have a lot of shade too for these like formal mentorship programs where they like pair you up with someone. It's sort of like the, what's that reality show, Love at First Sight, right? It's kind of like, you know, I don't know who you are, but there's a panel of experts who pair me with you, and we're going to be mentors forever, mentor mentee forever now, you know?
Yeah.
Some of those don't work. Just like Love at First Sight, actually. Oftentimes, those just don't work because they're not authentic. They're not genuine.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that those same programs do serve a real purpose, because there are some people who just, for whatever reason, they would not find it very easy to connect organically with a mentor. And these force that to happen, which is good. Some people need an extra push. I've also had some relationships that have grown through those mentoring programs. I never would have paired with this person ever before in my life. But because of the program, it forced me into a relationship that actually was very beneficial for me. A great example of this is Dr. Liz Schlodecker at Cincinnati Children's. She's an infectious disease doc. She was my first sort of formal mentor as part of the program when I joined the residency. And I had zero interest in infectious disease. And after my infectious disease rotation, what's less than zero? Some negative number? Like, I don't know. I have such great respect for infectious disease docs, but it's just not my cup of tea, you know, not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
But Dr. Schlodecker is just incredible. And like, she invited me over to her home and we had a wonderful time, and just, and we've stayed connected ever since. I don't reach out to her regularly for advice because I have many other people in the mentor network who can help me more specifically. But she is someone that I have reached out to not infrequently for other things, including times when I have trainees who want to do infectious disease and I want to connect them with someone that I think will be beneficial in their career. So no matter the situation, where you find the mentor, there's probably a value for them. I think the most important thing is getting outside of your bubble, getting outside of your ivory tower, meeting people in different places. Send that cold call, email, slide into somebody's DMs, respectfully, but slide into someone's DMs and ask them ask them advice or a question for advice or something. Be willing to go up to someone at a conference. These things are all important ways of pursuing mentorship.
Ray, I feel like we're getting the mentoring 3.0 or the mentoring 5.0 or 55.0 right now. So I feel like we could spend a whole hour or more talking to you, and just wanted to thank you so much for your incredible plenary. And I think that kind of what you just mentioned around like finding where people can fit, and kind of like everyone is in your life and kind of these connections and learning experiences and networking for a reason is a really, I think, unique lesson, and also one that we need to come back to. We also are recording a episode around working with Gen Z learners, which came up both in your 2.0 podcast, but also in a workshop that Lauren attended. We actually had one of the speakers from there on our podcast. So we will dive in more, but I don't know, Lauren, if you wanted to like highlight one or two quick points from the workshop that you went to.
Yeah, sure. So Mike and I actually attended this one together. So this is from the workshop called Bridging the Gap, Gen X Faculty, Millennial Chiefs, and Gen Z Residents in Academic Medicine. And Mike and I attended this one together. And I thought that the main, I know there's a whole other episode on this. Y'all check it out. Other episode on Gen Z. But as a Zillennial, like I'm mostly a millennial, but I'm very bored. I'm a cusper. I'm almost a Zillennial. And so this hit near and dear to my heart. And the main thing that resonated with me was the idea of centering on someone's onlyness or recognizing and valuing their point of view in the world from which an individual can speak and moving away from the generalizations or the hierarchy or the stereotypes from the generation from which they come. And so that means when you have a attending who's in their 60s and they say something you don't necessarily agree with, taking a step back to think about the experiences that that person went through, all the changes of technology that that person has seen in medical education, and thinking about the way what they're saying is this is a tried and true way of teaching for them that they've seen work throughout the dot-com boom and the switch to the EMR. And then likewise, when a Gen Z or millennial person is trying to advocate to their boss for being paid more or being funded, and it's not because, you know, there's often a perception that Gen Z feels entitled, but I think that we're also a generation where we have the most student loans out of any other generation. And I'm currently trying to think about buying a house in San Francisco, and I am a primary care doctor. So, you know, there's and the cost of buying a house now is different than what it was 30 years ago. And so I think my takeaway from that talk is centering back onto someone's onlyness, that attributes and their point of view in the world from which they can speak and act. And thinking about going back to that when you have a miscommunication or a generational difference that you experience.
I want to hear Mike's takeaways as well, but Ray, I just thought that that piece around the onlyness really kind of hit on the humanity and piece that you had mentioned around, like, there are going to be people that have their unique gifts and you can learn from them, you can kind of mentor with them, mentor through them, and I think those connections were really, really nicely done.
Identity is such an important topic. I think it's important for us to not forget, especially when we are engaging with mentees from another generation, Gen Z or, you know, Gen Alpha will be here before you know it too, in our medical schools.
So real.
And yeah, like I do think it's important for us to appreciate those differences and, yeah, well, we complain, you know, kids these days, you know what I mean? We'll complain, yeah. I'm sure, but it's always important to remember that identity is such an important formative factor in how we approach the world, including medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think tying into that as well, I was just thinking about this workshop where they're emphasizing, you know, appreciating the differences, but also finding the commonality, finding what thread ties you together. You know, some of the discussions we had, this is maybe a little preview or a kind of recap of our prior episode when we had Ellie on. But essentially, you know, having that same motivation to do good patient care, having that same unifying desire to be good doctors. So I think having that focus as well, because I think sometimes there can be a really heavy emphasis on the difference, heavy emphasis on how we are not the same, but, you know, obviously there's so many things that tie us together as well. So I thought that was kind of a nice emphasis of that workshop as well.
Lauren, I also heard that you went to another workshop focused on bite-sized learning. If you want to give us the title and maybe your one to two take-home points around that, and maybe we can all jump into bite-sized learning.
Sure. So I attended, as a Zillennial, I had I attended the workshops that were all very timely for this moment. So generational shifts, volunteerism in medical education, and AI. So I went to the workshop, Bite-Sized Learning, Curriculum Building and Best Practices for Generative AI and Large Language Models. And these were from our colleagues at University of Pennsylvania. So Gordon Folley, Janae Heath, and Daniel Lai. And I thought that it was a like packed room, wall to wall, standing room only. Everyone in there is excited and also mildly panicking about what we're doing about AI, because they asked the question, how many of your residents are using AI? Everyone raised their hands. Then they asked, how many of you all have it in a curriculum, or how many of you all have competencies in your programs around AI? And I think, 5% of the folks raised their hands. So we're all kind of in the same boat, trying to build this car as trying to drive this car as it's being built, you might say. And so I thought that the main takeaways were they discussed competencies for what we can teach in GME around AI. So number one, they had 4 points. Number one was foundational knowledge around what is AI, what is an LLM, what is machine learning, and just having the vocabulary as we're using these tools to engage in them. Number two is the ethics. How do we ask for consent when we record patients? How do we know when we can put PHI into an LLM, an LLM versus not? And then number three is skill development. So how do we, just like we appraise journal articles, and also how we identify like what's a phishing email and what's not? I'm really bad at that. We need to also develop the skills for AI output. So trying to figure out, is the AI giving you something that is actually based in reality, or is it hallucinating or being overconfident? And then the fourth one is, how do we integrate this into clinical care? How do we use AI? Again, going back to the de-skilling or never skilling, how do we incorporate AI into our practice? Because it is here, we can't ignore it while maintaining our other competencies. So some of the examples they gave were, at your new conference, having everyone do activity where everyone puts the same prompt into different AI search engines like Claude or Open Evidence, and seeing what comes out, whether it's different or whether it's the same. Modeling when you're precepting, when your students or residents are using AI, when you're precepting in clinic, asking your learners what prompts they use to put into AI and say, I would have prompted this differently to get this more specific result. And then there's also really cool things coming on. Like you can, the chiefs can put in all of their noon conferences from the last month and have it generate a podcast recapping all the greatest hits and learning points of your noon conferences. So there's just such endless opportunity for AI. That came up in this workshop, and I'm excited to see as AI iterates what will come up next year.
I don't know, Mike or Ray, if y'all have thoughts on that. That was a beautiful summary, Lauren. I feel like extensive, more than three take-home points. And we're gonna put them into, ChatGPT and summarize. But no, that was amazing. Thank you so much for sharing with our listeners. I don't know, Mike and Ray, if you have any reflections on that. That was incredible, Lauren.
I was just going to say I empathize with the mixture of excitement and apprehension that you were mentioning that people were feeling. Yeah, I'm excited to see what becomes of AI for the educational space. And, we're going to have an episode about that. And then I'm also curious or apprehensive in terms of obviously you mentioned the important guardrails that need to be there. So, yeah.
Yeah, certainly as the health equity guy, I'm constantly thinking about protecting our patients and our colleagues. By the way, I'm always thinking about how these tools, as much as we may want to pretend that these tools are entirely objective, they are engineered by human beings, and human beings are fallible. We can engineer bias into our electronic systems as much as we have engineered bias into the systems that are present in our everyday lives. And so we should always, always, always be on guard for how these human-engineered systems, which can do incredible things, and by the way, I use them all the time myself, these same systems can be harmful to some of the same vulnerable populations, marginalized populations inside and outside of the hospital who we've all been charged to serve. So I'm always looking for the ways in which we can champion justice in the face of new technology and, you know, our changing world.
I will say, Ray, I feel like new technology is kind of like the equivalent, the, I don't know, 2026 equivalent of your comment at the end of your episode with us last time, which was to ask when you're at a table, like who's not at the table or whose voice is missing. And I feel like this moment that Lauren just kind of brought us to was to ask ourselves who within AI or maybe whichever large language model you're using isn't maybe included, or is this, you know, technology biased and stigmatizing in some way towards some group that we just don't know, you know? And I think that's something that we, as an educator, as a curriculum developer, like we're trying to figure out ways to teach residents to appraise AI, much to what Lauren was kind of sharing. And so how do you get someone to appraise who's not at the table or who's not in the large language model? It's kind of a, it's like a, if the tree falls, does anyone hear it situation, you know?
That's such a vital observation, Ira. I really appreciate you saying that. I'll give you a quick hot take of mine. I shared one during the conference today. I have another that I can share. I am actually not, as the health equity guy, I am actually not worried much anymore about identifying health disparities, okay? Mm-hmm. I am much more worried about identifying health disparities and then choosing not to do anything about them. You know, the more that we think about it, disparities exist in any system. Any system mm-hmm. that human beings have developed, there will be disparities. To put it another way, in any system human beings developed, there will be winners and losers, right? Mm. Our job in healthcare is to level the playing field such that we give everyone an opportunity to achieve their best outcome. Okay. And to do that often requires us intervening when we see folks being left behind by the systems that we have developed. And so I've actually had many conversations over the last few years with colleagues, both at my hospital and elsewhere, who get really anxious, you know, when they think about disparities at our institution or at their institution, if it's not Nationwide mm-hmm. Children's Hospital. They, in fact, sometimes will speak about it in very hushed tones, like, oh, maybe we shouldn't publish this research because it might make the hospital look bad. It might make us look like we're discriminatory in some way or something like that. And I tell folks, instead, consider it differently. That us publishing our findings that demonstrate unfair differences that are prevalent in the systems that we have in our institutions, that is a marker of tremendous courage that says we have had the courage it takes to look at the problem, look at a problem that might exist within our institution and now choose to do something about it. That's the most important piece. So identifying mm-hmm. a disparity, you know, to me, that's actually no huge deal, right? Like it's important mm-hmm. for us to do it, but we would never say, oh, I'm not gonna look at our central line associated bloodstream infection rates because I'm afraid that if we look for those CLABSI rates, it might make us look like we're a dangerous hospital, right? No way, mm-hmm. it's really important for us to identify CLABSIs and to do something about really? Them. We should do the same when it comes to disparities. I think it links specifically to our discussion of AI because these systems, generative AI and the use of large language models in deriving as tools rather for achieving health outcomes, they are engineered with the same biases and the same risk of unfair disadvantages for some groups that other systems, that are included in other systems in healthcare. So we absolutely, you said it best, Ira, we have got to look and see who's not at the table. And we should invite those people, aggressively invite those people to join the table for with us when we're making decisions about how we use these tools.
Ray, pretty sure you said it best, but I appreciate the call out. Thank you. You're the best out there. Mike, Lauren, anything else that we need to recap or plug? I think maybe, Lauren, you'd gone to one more thing that we wanted to shout out.
So the last session I went to just before I came here was the plenary, The Hidden Tax, Ending Volunteer Era in Medical Education. This was from a group of folks, Brian Kwan, UCSC, Rebecca Griffiths at Atlantic Health, and Jennifer Reedlin at the University of Rochester. I'm particularly interested in this because when I was interviewing for faculty or clinician educator jobs, I said, how do you get time to do your educator work? And I went to this speed mentoring event, and every single person I asked that question said, you're going to have to do your work for free. And I said, that's fine. That's cool. Like, you know, I don't know if Gen Z and Gen Alpha are coming enough. I don't know if they're going to beat us down for that as I am. And so I feel like this session was particularly interesting in thinking about the paradigm shift of how we quantify education work.
So I'll say that for moving from volunteerism to professionalism, or incorporating more of educational work into our jobs, that some places think about educational value units instead of RVUs, they do EVUs, or how do you count the pennies of the educational work that clinician educators do? And they found that when they use these sorts of metrics to count those activities, it increased faculty attendance to conferences, completion and MedHub evaluations, which I know all programs struggle with, and increase in medical education scholarship. And they also had some practical points from this plenary about how to ask for funding, how to ask for money in ways that are productive and are more likely to increase your chances of getting that. So saying that I can help you with XYZ for this cause that our institution cares about, and I will need XYZ to be successful.
Lauren, I love that. I think if we can make the business case for folks to not have to do volunteer work, I think it gets back to the point you made at the very beginning of the plenary, which is that if there's a huge gap between what you're assigned and what you're actually paid for to do your work, there's a chance of attrition. And we all want there to not be clinician educator attrition. So I think there's a lot of kind of usable, practical application of what you just shared. Thank you so much. I don't know if you have a way, Lauren, or which particular thing you're going to use or apply in the future.
I think the thing I'm most going to apply is the SBAR, which is SBAR tactic, which is situation, background, assessment, and recommendation. Very similar to a SOAP note, actually, which is a good negotiation technique of describing your situation to the person you need money from, giving them the data or the background, giving your assessment of how you could help, and then your recommendation for how they could help you help them. So that's what I'm going to use going forward when I talk to my division chief.
I love it. I love it. Thank you. Thank you so much, Lauren. That was amazing. And Ray, thank you as well. That was, the recaps and highlights were incredible. And I think we, at least I felt like I was there at everything. I mean, some things I was there, but I felt like I was there at all the other sessions as well. Well, thank you guys so much.
This was great, guys. Thank you so much.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Teach. Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/teach. A special thanks to the Alliance for Academic Internal Medicine for helping make this season possible, to our whole team for the work behind the scenes, the script, the show notes writing, to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project. Thanks to the team at Podpace for editing and production support. Until next time, I've been Dr. Ira Krzyzanowskaya.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecurbsidersteach@gmail.com. A reminder that this and most episodes are available for CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. I've been Dr. Mike Chang. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you a little nugget of medication edutainment.